Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado and I'll be your host for this episode. And today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Marlon B. Ross about Sissy Insurgencies, a racial anatomy of unfit manliness, published by Duke University Press in 2022. Sissy Insurgencies focuses on the figure of the sissy in order to rethink how Americans have imagined, articulated, and negotiated manhood and boyhood from the 1880s to the present. Rather than collapsing sissiness into homosexuality, Ross shows how it constitutes a historically fluid range of gender practices that are expressed as a physical manifestation, discursive epithet, social identity, and political phenomenon. He reconsiders several Black leaders, intellectuals, musicians, and athletes within the context of sissiness, from Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, and James Baldwin, to Little Richard, Amiri Baraka, and Wilt Chamberlain, demonstrating that sissiness can be embraced and exploited to conform to American gender norms or disrupt racialized patriarchy. He also shows how it constitutes a central element in modern understandings of race and gender. Dr. Marlon B. Ross is professor of English at the University of Virginia, where he has taught since 2001. Before that, he was professor of English and African American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. His interests include a variety of fields related to race, gender, sexuality, and culture. And he's also the author of Manning the Race, Reforming Black Men in the Jim Crow Era, and The Contours of Masculine Desire, Romanticism and the Rise of Women's Poetry. Marlon, welcome to New Books in Gender Studies.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
So I like to start each episode by asking the authors to share with us their book's origin stories. So can you tell us, how did your book come about?
It was not something I had deliberately intended to write. It started many years ago when I added to my portfolio African-American studies. I was trained in graduate school as a British Romanticism scholar. But I got a request to write an essay on Black masculinity many, many years ago. And in response to that request, I just got obsessed with this question, and I started a two-volume project, the first volume of which was Manning the Race. And as I was writing Manning the Race, I kept noting in my own thinking this question of the sissy, this question of the queer Black male, especially in relationship to leadership. So I decided to turn my attention more directly to that, which led to this book, Sissy Insurgencies, before I turned my attention to the second volume of Manning the Race. That's a part of the origin story. The other part, of course, begins with my own origin as a sissy boy in South Texas under the regime of Jim Crow. And as I started thinking about sissiness and its relationship to race and to nationality, I but began to understand some of the complications of this phenomenon in relation to myself. And as a result, I did some autobiographical anecdotes in the original book, and most of that is gone now. but it did shape my approach in thinking about my own relationship to this topic.
Yes, I really enjoyed that there's an anecdote in the beginning of the book. I'm not going to give it away. Folks can read about it, but I love those moments where you talked about yourself as well. So I really love how you opened the book. The first sentence here is, "Once we begin to look at them, we see sissies everywhere." And this might sound like a straightforward question, but after reading your book, we understand the how it's not. Could you sort of try to define the sissy for us, sort of to get us into the story? What or who is a sissy, and how is this different from other terms used to refer to men who somehow fail to conform with gender norms and expectations? And throughout the book, you bring different terminology. You talk about language in very useful and interesting ways.
Yes, thank you. I would start by saying one of the reasons I was interested in using the sissy as a theoretical vehicle is because sissiness is at once a highly fixed and stigmatized object, and at the same time, it is highly fungible, that it's hard to put your finger on it, even as people think that they can spot a sissy very easily. I would define the sissy as a gender non-conforming male or boy whose gender comportment, and this relates to both the physical or material presentation of the self and also the psychological, emotional, internal, less decipherable aspects of what it means to conform to conventional masculinity. So the sissy, whether boy or man, is non-conforming, and immediately this tends to jettison us into the notion of the homosexual or the same gender loving male. But I wanted to theorize this distinction for a variety of reasons. One being that one can be gender non-conforming and not be same gender loving. And so I wanted to look at why that confusion or conflation of the homosexual and the sissy, how it's operating culturally, socially, politically, and ideologically, and what we could learn from separating the two and helping us to understand why the sissy is so stigmatized, even if the sissy is not a necessarily a homosexual. And that I thought that brought into clearer focus how gender nonconformity itself is seen as a danger to a larger society, even when it is not immediately attached to homosexuality.
So the book is divided into 6 chapters. Each one examines a different historical period. And as you put it, also a different aspect of the feud between sissiness and masculinity as a racialized dynamic. And this is an important point to make because throughout the book, you have this premise here that, and I'm quoting you, gender conformity is necessarily expressed through racial identification. So could you talk a little bit about this?
Yes. I wanted to explore how if we think of gender and race as being interdependent, interlocking a phenomena, then we have to say that a sissy configuration or a sissy conduct is always also a part of this interlocking dynamic. And as I looked at particular figures and particular events across American history and across African-American history, this was repeatedly confirmed for me that in the stigmatizing and the policing, the surveillance of sissy conduct, It's not necessarily the case that Black boys and white boys experience exactly the same kind of surveillance and stigmatization, though obviously there is a great commonality. So I wanted to think about the distinction that occurs, or the difference that occurs, when we include the important factor of race. And along with race come a number of other important attributes, like religion, like class, like political orientation, and not to mention that as boys, different racial groups are tutored, are taught to interact with the world in different ways based not only on their gender, but also their racial assignation. So a Black boy is being tutored to interact with the world, to be in the world, to walk within the world, to express himself within the world in a particular way that is supposed to alert people to his gender conformity. But race, I would say, gets in the way, if you will, of a kind of straightforward presentation, because Black boys are perceived in the public and then are taught to perceive themselves slightly differently, so that a Black sissy is not exactly the same conduct or perception as a white sissy boy.
Yes. I'm glad you brought that word up, because I want you to talk about, it's an important concept here that I wanted you to discuss as a means to continue introducing the book to our listeners, and that is conduct. You write here that, and I found that very useful, very interesting as well. You write that somewhere between identity and performance, performativity lies a much less analyzed arena that I label, or you label, conduct. What do you mean by conduct, and how does that inform the analysis here?
Conduct for me was absolutely essential once I began. If I start the book by saying, once you begin to look for them, sissies are everywhere. So my next question was, well, how do I know they're everywhere? How do I know there are, what is a sissy? And I began to realize that the surveillance of the sissy is usually done through spotting particular physical manifestations. And I will give an example to make it more concrete. The properly gendered male body is supposed to present itself in particular ways, or at least that's the assumption. And I was thinking of how this expresses itself in a variety of ways. The upper body, or what I call gesture, the lower body, or what I call gait, and the voice are three of them. How the register of the voice, as well as the dynamics of the voice. So I'll just give voice as a brief example. There is this idea that when a boy turns into a man, his voice must change as proof of that. And, you know, we see this everywhere. It's a very familiar idea that the high voice of the boy becomes deepened and gruffer. But along with that are ideas about the way men are supposed to speak. For instance, men are not supposed to elocute too precisely. If a boy or a pubescent boy is too precise in his elocution, that's enough of a signal for people to say, "Ooh, he's a sissy." I think the assumption is that his voice is not maturing into manhood the way it's supposed to be. And along with that is an assumption that men are not too precious when it comes to articulating their words. That's the preserve that is usually for women, because it's connected to emotionality, you know, all of these gender assumptions that are at work. And I'll give you a brief example from upper gesture. Especially, there is this notion of the limp wrist, which many people are familiar with, that the simple gesture of a male's limp wrist could immediately result in some sort of policing, and sometimes actually in physical violence, because the limp wrist is immediately taken as a sign of a boy or a man whose posture is not erect enough, whose posture is too soft. And we have, you know, we have many occasions of boys being ridiculed, being mocked, if they have a so-called limp wrist. Those are just a couple of examples of the sort of physical manifest signals that are taken to identify a sissy through conduct. And that's sort of where it begins. And of course, it deepens into the emotional and the psychological, the introspective, as the way we're perceived in the world affects the way we perceive ourselves. And so people who are labeled from an early age, boys who are labeled sissy from an early age, begin to doubt or question their relationship to the conventional, conventionally masculine. And it's that self-doubt, I think, itself that begins to display itself in subtle ways for boys who are not quite sure that they fit, or who are being told repeatedly that they don't fit. That can affect the conduct. It can affect a behavior. It can affect the way a boy talks with more hesitation than what a boy or a man is supposed to exhibit in, for instance, a situation of rivalry or danger, or of someone who is challenging him.
Yes, I'd like to thank you, because I am working on an oral history project with drag performers. So I talk a lot to feminine men, and this notion of conduct helped me understand a lot of the stories that they were telling of their childhood. And also that was
very interesting. Great.
But you explain here, right, that sissiness is not necessarily a physical attribute, and that you showed up very well in your discussion of Booker T. Washington. I'd like you to talk a bit about this distinction you make between a sissy social practice and sissy physical embodiment. And throughout the book, you have protagonists in the chapters, but you also bring other historical characters to discuss them. So I wanted you to talk also, how does George Washington Carver feature in this chapter? But before you answer, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that beautiful photograph of Carver in drag that you have in the book. That is just beautiful.
Yeah, I searched. It was hard under COVID because I couldn't get to the archives, but I was trying desperately to find out the original source for that photograph, and I was not able to find it. I'm going to continue the search, but I found the photograph in one of the biographies of Carver, and it's one of the things that shocked me and made me realize that I had to talk about Carver if I were to talk about Booker T. Washington and Tuskegee. So I do distinguish, for purposes of discussion, the what I call the physiological sissy, the sissy who displays those attributes, those physical attributes of a gait or gesture or voice that I was talking about earlier. And by the way, Carver had all of those, but I might come back to that, had all of those attributes. I distinguish the physiological sissy from, yes, a sissy of social practice. And what I mean by that, I think is best explained through the example of Booker T. Washington. I would start by saying that as far as we know from all of the historical record, Booker T. Washington was very much heterosexual and was conventionally masculine in terms of his comportment, right? In terms of, we can't know this absolutely, but we think we can know it because if he was not, it would have been commented on profusely. People would have brought attention to it because people bring attention when a male does not conform. But the way that he does not conform is in the narrative he provides of himself and the way in which his leadership is promoted and adjudicated in relation to the politics of the time. The best thing I can do is to give a couple of examples. In his Up From Slavery, his 1901 autobiography, he repeatedly represents himself in situations that are not supposed to be the case for a boy or a man. And he represents himself for instance, his entry to Hampton Institute. He represents himself as getting into Hampton by demonstrating his good housekeeping by perfectly dusting and sweeping a room for the schoolmistress, who was the person in authority to decide whether he could be admitted into the institution or not. And he goes on and on for pages about this pivotal moment of his sweeping for this northern Yankee schoolmistress, and how close he became to her, and how, because he could not afford to matriculate, she gave him a janitorial position where he would be responsible for the sweeping and the dusting. This puts him in the odd position of celebrating his, let's say, his identity within the institution in a role that was usually preserved for women. And this is highlighted as well by the fact that the authority over him is a white woman. And this idea continues to the point that I say that there's a way in which, in his relation to the larger white world under advancing Jim Crow, in order to make his leadership possible and plausible to the ruling white men, he constantly makes himself less intimidating to them by registering his acceptance of this role, this sort of sissy political position of not trying to occupy the place of a ruling white man, or a man who can rule over women, while at the same time, as head of his own institution, Tuskegee, he represents himself as a proper patriarch. So what we have is a dual audience. We have the Black audience, the students and faculty at Tuskegee, as well as the larger purview of the people who were dependent upon Tuskegee, because it became a major place for people to advance under Jim Crow to the extent that they could do so. He has that audience in which he comports himself as a proper patriarch. But for the larger world, he represents himself, and he behaves as a very humble doesn't get at it, as a man who is naturally sissified, is a man who will not make a claim to emancipation, where emancipation is a right to vote, is a right to a whole public office, is a right to be the head of a corporation, is the right to determine the final answer in governance, but instead to always be dependent on more powerful white men to do so, to approve of what he's doing. This is also amplified, or let me put it this way. The way I came to think about the way he was perceived as a sissy of social practice is the way his Black critics responded to him. And I will just give one example. W.B. Du Bois attacks Washington, his political program and his educational program, by saying that Washington saps the manhood of the race. And I say, in contemporary terms, we would say that Du Bois is punking Du Bois. He's saying he's not enough of a man. He's not saying that this is the case in terms of his sexuality or in terms of the way his body presents itself to the world. He's saying it in terms of the way his politics represents the race and the way his political agenda represents Washington himself as not man enough. The other word that Du Bois uses instead of sissy is sycophant. And so I do an etymology, and I talk about how sycophant, calling a man a sycophant in the political parlance of the time, was tantamount to calling him a sissy, or another word they use is a Miss Nancy, a man who is not equipped to deal with the hard knuckle real politics of the time, but instead depends on another man parasitically to do that work for him.
That is a fascinating chapter. But could you talk now about the conduct that you label here, gentle, manliness, and the pause was intentional because these are two separate words. And how do you see it applied to James Weldon Johnson?
Could I just say a brief word about Booker T. Washington before I move on?
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry, about Carver. In contrast with Washington, George Washington Carver is a physiological sissy. And I just want to point out that not only did he cross-dress more than once, he also pursued very feminine identified vocations like crocheting and knitting and water sketching, etc. And that he chose to live in the women's dorm, or they put him in the women's dorm as opposed to the men's residence hall. And all of that was very curious to me. And then I saw places where he was being attacked in a similar way by one of his male colleagues at Tuskegee, that Washington was being attacked by Du Bois, but in a way that alerts us to his gender nonconforming physicality. And so I just use that as a contrast to think about the two different ways in which during this period of the early 1900s, sissification could work. The last thing I would say here about Carver is that there's not a lot of attention to Carver's sissiness during, if we look at newspaper reports, et cetera, during the time, because it was largely protected by the Jim Crow institution in which he worked for all of his adult life, by Tuskegee. So there's a way in which Washington's Tuskegee, this Jim Crow institution, protected George Washington Carver from the larger public and allowed him to conduct himself really as a sissy within those enclosed environments of the Jim Crow institution. This is absolutely not the case for James Weldon Johnson, because he was very much a man of the world, very much a cosmopolitan. He's the first African-American head of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He was very early on a diplomat in Central America. He represented the United States in Japan at an important conference. So he's very much interacting with the world on the world stage. And he does so, like Booker T. Washington, as physically as a gender-conforming man. He does so also in terms of his sexuality, which we think, we're pretty sure, is heterosexual. But I would say he adapts his gender in order to deal with the threats that he had to confront as the leader of the race during this high period of Jim Crow, where lynching and racial mobs were very much a part of the culture of the time. So my argument is that when you read his autobiography and his most famous novel, The Ex-Colored Man, when you read these two texts together, you realize that James Weldon Johnson is highly self-conscious about being a gentle man, a man who defies the characterization of the race, of men of the race, as either brutes or Uncle Toms. Instead, he forges this representation of himself that is very much restrained in a way that diplomats must be restrained. But at the same time, he is a fighting man. But he says that he fights passively and that he bends like the willow, right, in circumstance. We see many instances of this in his autobiography. And should I just give one brief example, or?
Yes, please.
He was almost lynched when he went to his hometown of Jacksonville, Florida, because he was in a park with a woman who was very light in color. And there was some militia from deeper in the South who were there in town. And these militia, when they see him with this white appearing woman, they think it's a black man with a white woman, and they begin to attack him And he records in meticulous detail how he responded to this militia that is about to attack him. He responds with a masculine aggressive attack. He responds passively by allowing the mob to come up to him. And his main concern was for the woman who is with him. And he takes her parasol and he allows her to step through this fence. And he behaves like a gentleman, even though he's very likely about to be lynched. In that moment, he is saved by a military officer who recognized, because he was a famous man by this point, a military officer who recognizes who he is and who comes to his rescue and deters the mob and says, I will take him under my authority. So the mob assumes, the militia assumes that he's being arrested when actually he's being rescued. So I point out that he allows himself to be rescued like a damsel in distress, and he makes no bones about this because it's the way he survives this incident. But he still survives, if you will, with his manliness intact to the extent that he represents himself as, in a way, superior to that mob. He responds like a man with coolness, with calm, with restraint, a gentleman and a gentle man in the midst of a lynching mob.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I really appreciate how you place these authors and their works in historical context. It becomes very vivid. You understand their expressions of masculinity and or sissiness in these concepts. So that brings us to chapter 4, that's entitled Baldwin's Sissy Heroics. And I think until now we had not seen anyone who was quite as openly gay in the book. So I'd like you to tell us what you mean when you talk about Baldwin's sissy defiance or sissy heroics, but also because I'm interested in historical context, I wanted you to talk about the role of mass media of the period, which you bring in here so brilliantly in how Baldwin was perceived and presented himself.
Yes. I had to talk about Baldwin, and I needed a chapter devoted to Baldwin and to the response to Baldwin's sissiness, because I think it's a pivotal moment that is related to mass media. If you think back for a moment to Carver, the only way that people could have seen Carver in any sort of popular or mass context would have been his speaking to a large audience, obviously in person, right? So there's a limitation in that period. There's a certain limitation, or for him, an opportunity, because it means that even if he would physically display sissiness, its translation into the mass is not quite as immediate as when we come to the period of, especially of television. For Baldwin in his period, he was one of the most televised persons in America. He was constantly on television, on panels, on talk shows, in speeches. His body is everywhere and is being beamed into the living rooms of Americans of every ethnicity, of every social background. And so we have a pivotal moment in which a person's legible physical manifestation of sissiness can be read, can be spotted in this sort of visual medium. And the irony or the paradox is that I suggest Baldwin does not hide his sissiness. Whatever physical manifestation he had in voice or in gesture or in gait, he allowed that to be. And he allowed that to be beamed to a broad public. I'm not sure if he could have behaved in a different way, but knowing Baldwin, I don't think he would have. I think my argument is that it is part of his insurgency. It is part of his defiance to not try to manage his body in such a way that it would not be read as a sissy. The other thing I would point out about Baldwin is that in his work, both his fiction and his essays, which frequently reference his autobiography, he constantly refers to himself both as a sissy and in other ways, identifying his gender nonconformity. He also never says I am queer or I am homosexual in the way that a lot of people wanted him to. And that is interesting in itself, the fact that he doesn't. But it is obvious he never denies or tries to hide his homosexuality. So this is a case where the sissy converges with the homosexual. And I will provide an example here. By 1963, Baldwin was at the height of his fame. He had published his novel, Another Country, in 1962, and homosexuality is all across that novel. And so anyone who had any doubt, they would have just said, well, anyone who's writing this much about queerness, about male queerness, it must be gay. And of course, he had written other fiction before that also was about homosexuality. But this book was the best selling novel of the time. In 63, he writes The Fire Next Time, which also was a best-selling essay. And so he's at the height of his fame. And he appears on the cover of Time magazine. And I have an essay on this. I did not reprint the cover of Time magazine in the book, but I have an essay that does reprint it. And this what's interesting about the cover is it's just a headshot of Baldwin. And I point out that it's hard to designate someone a sissy from a headshot. And it talks about him as the spokesman or the voice for the civil rights movement on the cover. Then when you turn inside the magazine, the article on Baldwin is all about his sissiness, is all about the way he smokes a cigarette, the way he fretters with his hand, the way his hand, it almost says a limp wrist, and the way he talks and the way he gestures, he fidgets in his seat. It talks about him as little, as being too little. So all of these adjectives add up, and I've shown many other instances of how people add up these kinds of adjectives in order to indicate a sissy sensorium. All of these things. So in other words, the author of that article is calling Baldwin out as a sissy, and in an underhanded way is questioning, well, how did somebody like this become a leading voice of this civil rights movement? And so this is a moment, you know, in which Baldwin is beginning to be attacked by the rising Black Power movement, represented especially by Malcolm X, and later by the Black nationalist Lakamira Baraka. And they are also calling him out in very, very vivid and nasty terms. As gender nonconforming, as a, you know, the F word, as a faggot. And Baldwin responds to this, I argue, by instead of, you know, trying to deny, instead of simply, you know, saying you're wrong, he responds by making a case in his presentation of his body and his voice and in his intellectual discourse, making a case for the role of a sissy on the front line of leadership. And, you know, I try to make this case, especially through the text, No Name in the Street, which he published in the early 70s, where he's very directly responding to the attacks on him for not being a proper man at the head of a revolution. The last thing I would point out here is that at the same time that these young Turks, we might call them of the new Black nationalist movement, many of them are attacking Baldwin, they are also attacking the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. People may remember that Malcolm X attacks his program by saying, in no war do you put men and children on the front line, which is a way of calling the Reverend King out and suggesting that he's not behaving like a proper male warrior at the head of a movement. And it's also a way of suggesting that the movement is not a revolution, but is something other and less than. So Baldwin's very aware of all of that. And so he calculates and he represents another way of thinking about the civil rights movement, another way of thinking about racial liberation that does not rely on these hyper-masculine tropes of the warrior and of the fighting man and of, you know, and of, you know, of even the man who has to refuse to have any sort of contact with outside of the race.
It is an incredible chapter. It's so rich. There's this the Baldwin's role in the civil rights movement. We have, as you mentioned, is this relationship, complex relationship with the Black nationalist movement. But you also, as you did in the other chapters, you bring in other sort of characters to contrast to Baldwin that I found really interesting. I really was interested in your discussion of, for instance, of Truman Capote and Andy Warhol to discuss the race here. But also when you bring in Little Richard and Sylvester, right?
Yeah.
So this is an amazing chapter. We could do a whole episode on it so folks can read all about it. But then the next chapter begins with the following question. How do you spot a sissy when he's a straight Black man? So tell us a bit about the straight sissies you are discussing and when you talk about the Black male intellectuals' autobiographies of the 1990s.
This is a kind of elaboration of the second chapter on Booker T. Washington, which we could think of as a straight sissy, right? As a heterosexual man who's gender nonconforming. So I wanted to think about how at the turn into the 20th century, we have this Black male leader who presents himself in a non-gender conforming way in terms of his political program. And then at the end of the century, ironically, we have a set of Black male intellectuals after the fame of Baldwin, contending with what it means to claim leadership of the race in a post-civil rights moment after the emergence of second wave feminism, after the emergence of the lesbian and gay rights movement, and in the midst of the desegregation of elite previously white universities. So in this period, I wanted to trace the straight sissy as a kind of influence from Baldwin that these Black male intellectuals could not avoid. And that's why I pivot the chapter with Amira Baraka. And I point out that when you look at Baraka's early work, before he became a Black nationalist, he represents himself in ways that are very close to Baldwin's sissy pose. Even though he does not identify himself as homosexual, and I wasn't really interested in whether he was straight or gay or not, but I was interested in the fact that he talks about his very close friendship and collaboration as a literary figure with white homosexuals. And by the time he becomes a Black nationalist in the mid-1960s, he's very interested in purging, let's say, that sissy within, that intimacy with sissiness, whether it's the Black sissy Baldwin or the white sissies of the Beat movement, like Allen Ginsberg, whom he had this relationship with. And so Baraka, as a Black nationalist, begins to help to articulate this idea that for that a proper Black man in the post-civil rights moment must be a particular kind of warrior, even if he is really just a writer. And so the equation between the pen and the weapon becomes one of his biggest metaphors as a way of as distancing himself from his earlier sissy persona. So that by the time we get to the 1990s, we're dealing with another kettle of fish, so to speak. The Black public intellectuals of the 1990s are trying to situate themselves so that they are, on the one hand, acceptable to second wave feminism, which is demanding a man, it's demanding a masculinity that is, in today's term, we would say no longer toxic. And on the other hand, they are responding to the Afrocentrist movement, which is a descendant of Black nationalism. And the Afrocentrists were demanding that Black male leadership return to a patriarchal role. They were attacking the progress of the gay rights movement and suggesting that this movement, that the Black homosexual is a threat to the Black family. Because with any nationalism, one of the motives becomes procreation, to procreate and to lead and to head the race as a proper patriarch. So, you know, and there are many other forces at work, but those are two that I was looking at how they navigate this on the one hand, reasserting their straightness, right? Their heterosexuality, but on the other hand, pointing out that they understand this new era in which feminism and gay rights are important, and they become, let's say, allies, to use a contemporary term. They become allies of feminism and allies of the gay rights movement, and they do so by representing themselves as sissies, or rather, more precisely, writing these memoirs and these autobiographies where they represent themselves as having been sissy boys in their youth. And that sissiness in their youth, they're not belonging to the heteronorm, informs their ability to adjust themselves to the demands of this new era in which men can no longer simply assume leadership by virtue of their maleness, but instead must accommodate gender equality and must accommodate sexual orientation inclusion. So that's my explanation for why the self epithet, if you will, of the straight sissy becomes something that they embrace. And I guess the last thing quickly I would say is that this is also the way that they navigate these new, their positions as the first generation to desegregate elite white universities around the United States. You know, they have colleagues, they have white women, they have white men as colleagues, and they also have some of the very same Black men who are Black nationalists. I mean, Amira Baraka was a professor at Stony Brook University, and other of these Black nationalists also were coming into these institutions. And so you have this interesting collection, if you will, that they are having to navigate all at once.
Yes. And then we move from the straight sissy to folks who identify as gay but not sissy. And sort of like a genre of gay sports disclosure memoir that you talk about here, how this attempt to clearly separate gay identity from the stigmatizing stereotypes of sissiness. And what's really important in this chapter, what I found most interesting, is how you show once again the role that race plays in that effort. You begin the chapter with some memoirs written by white athletes, and then you talk about some that were written by men of color, gay men of color. Could you talk a bit about this sort of genre of the gay sports disclosure memoir?
Yes, the context of these memoirs is the growing acceptance of gay men within the larger body politic. But the reason I wanted this chapter to be last is because I was thinking of the two places that are, in a way, the last preserve of the straight heteronorm, and that is the military and professional sports. Especially professional contact sports like boxing and football. And so I was curious about how these athletes, black, white, and other from other ethnic groups, how these professional gay athletes justify their right to be on the playing field or on the court by distancing themselves from sissiness. So they make gayness acceptable in the sports arena by pointing out that they are conventionally masculine men. And if you're conventionally masculine, then, oh, you can play the game. You can be on the field as tough as any other man because the exception or the difference of sexual orientation is irrelevant to the way one plays sport, but sissiness is perceived as not being so. This to me is part of a larger pattern in the gay rights movement by the 1980s and 1990s. There was this notion in the sort of mainstream LGBT movement, well, the T wasn't there yet, but the LGB movement, that the best way to achieve inclusion in the body politic was to present, let's say, a respectable facade that would seem to fit with the prevailing conventions of masculinity and femininity, to make sexual orientation irrelevant. And these memoirs, these gay disclosure memoirs of these athletes was, for me, a perfect case study of that. So race becomes important because what I noticed in these memoirs, and we only have a handful of them because we only have a handful. We only have a handful of professional male athletes who self-identified as gay. And among that group, we only have a smaller handful who have written these memoirs. But I noted how in the early memoirs, several of them written by white athletes, that there was this very strong, what I call sissy avoidance, or even sissy purging that occurs, that they go to the extreme in making the case for them being normative athletes because they are normatively gendered. And to do so, they have to have these cases, these instances of where they represent themselves as not sissies. But what I noted was that in the memoirs written by non-white professional athletes, there was a more complicated relationship to the sissy, and that frequently they seemed to me more self-conscious about not fully distancing themselves from the sissy, but instead indicating a kind of fluidity. They might say, well, I'm not a sissy, or actually in a couple of instances, they do claim being sissies earlier on, sort of like the straight sissy memoirs of the 1990s. But they make it complicated in that one could be a sissy and still be tough, or one can be affiliated with sissies and still be tough. And I suggest that this is a part of a longer tradition within African-American culture, where we have the concept of the fierce sissy or the tough sissy, the sissy, the street sissy, the one, the sissy who's on the street. And this is Little Richard is an example of this, the sissy who can comport himself with the display of a physiological sissy, but at the same time, defend himself both with his mouth and with a knife if need be. And so I think there's a slightly different history of the embodiment of the sissy on the street in African-American culture than what we see with figures like, let's say, Truman Capote as a representation of the white sissy in the larger culture.
Yes, we have an archetype of the fierce sissy in Brazil in a historical character called Madame Satan. There's actually a beautiful film about him.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Oh, I'll send you the reference.
Oh, great. Thank you.
This chapter almost made me want to watch that. There's a Netflix series about a white football player is coming out. Cody or something like that. I think I'm going to watch it just because of your chapter. There is so much for us to talk today, but we are sort of running out of time. But I wanted you, before we go, could you share with us what are you working on now? What are you working on next? What can we expect from you after this wonderful book?
I am working on an edited volume with Kenrick Ian Grandison called Race, Space, and Culture. It's a collection of essays that looks at the way in which race shapes our experiences with and design of space, and the ways in which the racialization of space shapes our understanding of race. So that's a volume of a variety of scholars from across disciplines writing on this topic. I'm also working on the second volume of Manning the Race, which is the literary cultural history of the representation of Black masculinity in across the U.S. The first volume focused on the 1890s through the 1930s, through the Harlem Renaissance. And the second volume is a history of Black masculinity from the World War II period through the present. And I'm almost finished with that second volume. It's called The Color of Manhood.
Well, both sound incredible. The first book of the this series is amazing. I'm looking forward to reading both and hope you'll come back to talk to us when they're out.
Oh, I would be happy to.
But thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
No problem. I enjoyed it. And again, thank you for inviting me.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I just spoke with Dr. Marlon B. Ross about Sissy Insurgencies, a Racial Anatomy of Unfit Manliness, published by Duke University Press in 2022. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.